Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey everybody, welcome to Spotcast Season 6, Episode 39. Just two episodes past the famous 37.
In a row?
In a row, yeah, exactly. My name is Tim Mitchell. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Jonathan Kuhlein in Mississauga, Ontario.
How's it going?
Ha ha! And we also have... and over there by the refrigerator, checking all the eggs, is Jaime Lopez Jr.
How's it going?
No, I already said that. You have to pick something else. I called it this week.
Hey, kids, or whatever it is that he says.
Hello there, kids.
Hello there, kids. All righty. Once again, we published two episodes last week. We were perfect. Bang on. So Oof. There is no fact check.
Oof.
Well, there probably was some fact check, but I forgot to make note of it. Oh, well. So moving on to the headlines, I found this link rather interesting. I think it showed up on the Facebook, so I took a minute and read it. I barely remember most of it, but this is a brief history of the progenitors in Star Trek, which is the uber MacGuffin in this year's season. Talking about, you know, how the theory of the progenitors, you know, my big complaint was, well, how come all the aliens throughout Star Trek lore all have, you know, two arms, two legs, a nose and ears and two eyes. And this big long article like goes through all the different episodes where progenitors are taking place in Star Trek lore. But I think just like the transporter was invented, the reason why all of the characters in Star Trek universe are humanoid, according to Gene Roddenberry, is because humans are cheaper.
Yeah, I think we knew that one, but I'm curious to see how they land this one. We'll talk about it when we get into our discussion about the latest episode of Discovery. But I thought it was far-fetched, as did many fans when they did this episode on TNG all those years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're building a whole season around this concept, and I have some questions, which we will talk about in the next half hour or so.
Yeah, there's another throwback in this episode that we're going to talk about too that comes up a little bit later. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you're talking about the episode where the Romulans and Picard and all kind of come together and they meet the progenitor who's...
Yep.
Well, isn't that related to the person in the bucket from Deep Space Nine?
No, they just coincidentally happen to look very similar.
Oh, okay. They're the same actor. That would be Salome Jens.
Yeah.
Well, same actor. Oh, really?
Yeah, I had to look this up to make sure. But the Wikipedia tells us that in 1993, Star Trek The Next Generation, humanoid progenitor in the episode The Chase. And then from 94 to 99 on Deep Space Nine, the female changeling, a recurring role from seasons 3 to 4 and 6 to 7.
So she was in, well, obviously she was in TNG before she was in Deep Space Nine, right?
That's right. A year prior. So just as they commonly do, they bring the same actors back. You know, Jeffrey Combs, we've talked about being in a bunch of shows.
Mm-hmm.
So, only two shows here, TNG and Deep Space Nine, but a very lengthy role, a recurring role in Deep Space Nine during the Dominion War.
Yeah. Yeah.
My favorite double use, the one that has always stuck out to me, is Mark Alaimo, who was Gul Dukat in Deep Space Nine, has a very brief moment in the episode of TNG where Data goes, remember the one where they find his head and then he ends up in California in the 1800s, and he comes in and he's trying to figure out, like, well, okay, now what do I do? And he goes to play poker.
Mm-hmm.
And he sits down at the table and he sort of throws his comm badge on the middle of the table and starts a conversation with these guys. And one of the people at the table, the one who picks it up and takes a bite out of it to see if there's gold in there, is Mark Alaimo in just regular human guise and
human form.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
distinctive voice, though, I take it, right?
Definitely so. And because he says, you know, because Data, remember, Data always has the running joke where he says, I am from France, which yeah. I think is a Coneheads joke.
Yes, it is.
He says, you know, I'm from France. And he says, you know, oh, you know, in French, Marco Limo says, in French, he says, I'm also, you know, I'm from New Orleans. I happen to also speak French. And Data in French says, oh, we're like brothers. Like, you know, my parents are originally from this place. And it's really funny because obviously it's like continuing the gag of, yeah, Data's French.
For the insiders.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, right. That would be the episode Time's Arrow from
Great one.
TNG.
Mm-hmm. Good call back there. So, and then my next piece here is it's just a quick little, I saw this on Threads, actually. Matt Damon he's on the show where the spicy chicken wing eating thing, I forget what that was called.
Is it Hot Ones
or something?
I think
Hot Ones, yeah.
So he makes an interesting point because the question they ask him was, and it's related to something we've talked about on this show 1,000 times, was the decisions in terms of what kind of movies they make. And Matt Damon's answer is that, you know, back in the before time, like before streaming, you had DVD sales to back up theater sales, right? So if you didn't do well in the theater, you could catch up with that in the, because you knew you had the DVD sales coming up, right? And we've often wondered about like why some movies, you know, are horrible in the theater and then have a great run on DVD. You can probably think of 1,000, even on VHS. I think, you know, things like Clerks and stuff like that. Were much better, much more well received once they hit VHS, right? And he said that like now that there's streaming, you don't have that second revenue stream. So, you know, and I think Kevin Smith talked about this once in one of his talks about how he was talking about Harvey with the Weinstein Company and how they would, you know, they would put so much money into a movie and they would put the same amount of money, like millions of dollars, into advertising that movie, right? To get people to go to see it and stuff like that, right? So that's why the budgets get big and blown out. And so now it really is painful if they put a movie out in the theaters and they don't make the money they need to make in the box office, right? So that's why he was talking about the particular types of movies that were being made back then. They had a bit more latitude in terms of what choices they made in terms of stories. But it's an interesting little 30-second soundbite from Matt Damon about, you know, the difference between movies being made today and movies being made in the past, in the before streaming time. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely right. It's not the same world that we're sort of reared on home entertainment. I mean, it's a strange one too, because it's about the sort of the streaming world now, right? Everything goes to streaming. And you know, we talk about it even in the episodes. We talk about, you know, oh, that movie looks okay, I'll wait for it to come to streaming. You know, you can still rent stuff. You can still, like, you just, I don't know, how often do you guys rent something off of a VOD kind of situation?
Maybe once a year.
Yeah. Basically, whenever my Amazon credits for delaying deliveries, you know, like, oh, I don't need that immediately, and they'll give me a buck or two for digital credits. When those go enough in value that I can get a movie for free around, you know, $5.99, that's when I spent them.
Wait, you get credits from Amazon?
Yeah. America. So I don't know how they make this determination. It's not every single time on the same products. They'll just give you a prompt at the checkout. You know, do you want this, you know, today, in 2 days? Oh, would you like to wait, you know, I don't know, it's about like a week or more.
Really?
In exchange for, you know, a week or more delivery in exchange for like $1 or $2 digital. You could use it for like Amazon Music. Use it for the video on demand, you know, rentals.
Yeah.
They do expire. So it's unfortunate that they seem to be rolling on like a, I don't know, quarterly basis, I would guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't make it super easy to find in your account. So every once in a while, it's like, hey, your balance of however much it is about to expire. I'm like, oh, thank you. Let me go onto Amazon and see what would probably be on Redbox really soon. And I'm just using it to get set stuff for free.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
it's funny. Like I don't get credits that way. And there are cases where I would opt for that. Like if I'm buying filters for my air filter thing or whatever, but I often get them with movie tickets from Cineplex. And then I forget to use them before they expire, sort of thing. Get a free rental. Right. Anyway, yeah, I use them for things I don't want to, I wouldn't want to buy, and don't want to go to the theater for. So
yeah, I've done that too. I've gotten the free Cineplex movies and cashed that in. But even then, you know, the time frame that they give you, the, you know, by the time it comes to VOD there, in a lot of cases, it's like maybe a few weeks before you'd be able to watch it on a streaming service. So it's not
that's kind of meh. Yeah. All right. Over to you for the next one, John.
Yeah, a few little updates this week. The Game of Thrones spinoff that was supposed to focus on Jon Snow is apparently toast, or your show is now nothing, Jon Snow. They were talking about this last year, the fact that they were going to do this, Kit Harington was going to lead this sort of story of what Jon Snow's life was like after the events of Game of Thrones. And it was interesting because, you know, obviously they've gone the prequel route. They've already got House of the Dragon. They've already greenlit doing a Dunkin' Egg series that is focused on, again, more sort of pre stuff. But this was going to be the one that focused on the after, which is always an interesting thing to sort of explore. But apparently they've decided that there's just not enough there yet. Maybe people aren't wistful for what happens to Jon Snow after this, but he basically said, you know, we talked about it and it's not happening. It's not happening anytime soon. He said they talked about it. They bounced some ideas around, but in the end they decided that there just wasn't a good path for them to follow. So they're not going to be doing that. I'm curious to explore it, but like what I want, and I think what fans would probably prefer is the Arya story that they sort of set up a little bit of, you know, Arya is going to go explore the lands beyond the sea on the other side of Westeros. I think that makes for a much more interesting series. The drag with that is that, you know, Maisie Williams is busy and working and she doesn't want to necessarily jump back into doing Game of Thrones again. So, but I don't know, you guys, any great regrets of this not happening?
I'm trying to remember what happens to Jon Snow at the end of the Game of Thrones. All I remember is
he goes north. He gets banished by his brother Bran. His Bran becomes the king. Spoilers, by the way, if you haven't heard Game of Thrones,
please.
Really? Your time is up now. But Bran, his brother, basically for killing the queen, for killing Daenerys, he's basically sent to the wall again. And as soon as he gets there, he basically goes out the other side and joins the wildlings. And he and Tormund go with the people and head north. So it's, him and his wolf and they all go with the wildlings or whatever they're calling them now that they're no longer wildlings. But that's basically just the last thing you see of him is just, you know, he's lost. He's lost pretty much everything. He's lost his first love. He's lost his, you know, his latest love. He's just basically kind of broken. And he's like, I'm just going to go live in the north now.
Interesting.
Yeah. I wonder what the original idea was, because this link here that you have says it was Kit Harington who brought the idea to us that George R. R. Martin had wrote in a blog entry at the time that was brought.
Yeah. I mean, clearly there was enough there that they went forward enough to make it public they were going to do this. So,
wasn't he in the Incombustibles or whatever? You know, the other movie that came out that was like from where? What? And he was a spoiler at the end.
I don't know.
In Sentibles or Incustibles or something.
I'm going to look this up.
Incredibles? No.
Eternals?
Eternals, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, he was in all of Eternals, right? He's dating one of the Eternals at the beginning, and then he sort of pops in and out. He plays Dane Whitman, the Black Knight from comic books, and they kind of set him up as this. He's got this family legacy. He's got this sword, and they kind of tease, oh, he's going to pick up the sword at the end of the movie in the little stinger, and then someone says, "I wouldn't do that if I were you," and we know that that's Blade that is talking to him.
So who was the actor playing at the very end of the movie?
Who did they recast as Blade? It's the guy from Moonlight.
Mahershala Ali.
Mahershala Ali is the new Blade. Yeah, but again, considering Eternals kind of tanked, and word is that they're
completely
not
forgotten it 100%.
Well, and they're not. They've apparently decided they're not going to try and do like a trilogy out of Eternals. They're just going to leave that as a one-off that introduces some other characters, even though it teased like a whole bunch of stuff. So,
right. Okay.
Next up, we've got a couple of trailers. So first one is Joker, Folie à Deux, the second of the new standalone Joker movies, the first of which won its lead actor an Oscar. I still have not seen it. The trailer for this one was pretty bizarre. And I don't have any desire to see this either. How do you, I know, Tim, you watched it. What were your sort of takeaways from this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, to me, it's like, give Joaquin Phoenix a sandwich would be the first question for thing. I don't know. I kind of wonder about the casting of Lady Gaga as the femme fatale in this one. I don't know who the Phoenix character is, but, because I thought his girlfriend in the comics was the Margot Robbie character.
Harley Quinn is his, and apparently that's who Lady Gaga is playing in this iteration. She's Harley Quinn.
Okay, because it said Phoenix at the in the sort of words that went by, so I wasn't sure which world I was watching.
Yeah,
Also watching him do the what's his name from The Dark Knight, the Heath Ledger fast walking. On one hand, it's a unique performance. He's pretty good. I mean, Oscar worthy. Yeah, I guess he is to a certain extent, but I mean, it's kind of like he's doing Heath Ledger, you know, it's a combination of Heath Ledger and Jared Leto's Joker. I guess it's his own take on it, but it just reminds me so much of that, but he is pretty powerful in the character, I gotta say, but still. I'll probably watch it, but yeah, I just question the whole. I get it now that if she's going to be Harley Quinn, then I guess it could be Lady Gaga. But I've not seen her in that other movie with Rocket Raccoon, you know, the singing one. Bradley Cooper.
A Star is Born. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah, I've seen the Star is Born twice. I don't need to see it a third time. Is what my point is, right? So. I think the best Star is Born portrayal was the one by Judy Garland, but that's neither here nor there.
Jaime, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the first Joker movie with Joaquin Phoenix is a pretty solid entry in that sort of mythos. It's not necessarily connected to anything else save for this, the sequel movie. And it's a really good way to feel sad. If you think of it that way, like it's not a happy, uplifting movie. And this one from the trailer, I kind of wonder where it goes next in terms of exploring that character. The first movie is kind of a man's descent into madness. And what is this one? From what we see, it kind of feels like a lot of it's going to be fantasy in their heads, how they see themselves and each other. Versus it being like a lot of things actually happening, or at least the people that made the trailer did a really good job of making it really unclear what the plot line's going to be. So I appreciate the fact that they didn't just give away everything.
Yeah, it did sort of have that. I mean, the whole thing about psychosis is that, they say that psychosis, or, you know, you build a fantasy world and then you move in. That's what the definition of psychosis is, right? And they... like there's a scene in the middle where they're dancing together in the moonlight kind of thing. And, you know, in fancy dress. And it turns out that they're actually dancing. They're just in their minds seeing themselves that way. Right. So, I mean, that's what I gathered from the trailer. So it's interesting. I guess they're going to be like a power duo crime, Lord syndicate thing based on what I see in the story. Right. And of course, Arkham's tied in there too. So this could all be in their heads. Right.
Yeah. The whole thing, there have been stories told, particularly a couple of really good ones in comic form that talk about sort of the how his madness infects her and how, he drags her down to his level and everything else. There's been some interesting explorations of that over the years. So for me, it kind of feels like well-worn turf. And I feel like that's maybe why I'm not really interested in this. I know Lady Gaga, I think she's an excellent musician. I think I've enjoyed her work. I'm not like a super fan. but I know she comes with her own baked in audience. I know that there's going to be the sort of weird, you know, inside the mind musical numbers and stuff in this one. So again, maybe she's perfect. I just don't find this, any of this really does anything for me. And I'm not a Joaquin Phoenix fan. I really think he's a bit of a ham-fisted actor. So doesn't appeal to me at all.
Right.
And on that note, let's move to our next trailer.
So that one, what I wanted to interject with is like, so Hollywood is listening. He's like, got it. They're taking notes the exact same way. All right. So it's going to be a buddy cop movie starring Joaquin Phoenix and Tom Cruise. Got it. Budget of $350 million. Let's go.
That would probably just about cover it. Yeah. The next trailer we've got is for a video game, but a pretty interesting looking one. The first trailer for Star Wars Outlaws came out this week. This is a game coming later this year, and it is set sort of on the underworld side of the Star Wars universe. The trailer shows this lead character who is sort of, you know, trying to make a living in a pretty messed up galaxy where the Empire is obviously got a tight control on things, but also there's these sort of space mafia, you know, all these different groups all working to control little pieces of the black market and everything else, and the crime world. And the graphics look pretty spectacular. The game looks pretty interesting, and it's obviously not, you know, this isn't one where coincidentally you happen to find a lightsaber and suddenly you have the ability to use the Force. It seems much more grounded, a little more sort of street level, and it looks fun. What did you guys take out of this one?
I just watched it really quickly, but I mean, it's kind of like the where you kind of think the Han Solo story should go, kind of thing, you know, like,
yeah.
He's just a guy, you know, trying to make a living in a world, you know, but it's interesting, like, from the point of view, like, they've got all the sort of hooks in there, like, the, you know, the battle cruisers and, you know, aliens and things like that. And, of course, the blasters and things to make it appeal to, you know, people who want more out of Star Wars than they're getting, right? So, interesting. And you're right, the graphics looks really amazing, like, rendering-wise. Over to you, Jaime.
For my opinions on the game, it looks interesting. Some of the art does remind me of the Horizon series of games, and some of the animals that are involved.
I do like that about the animated and the video game versions of the Star Wars universe, that they are much more rich with, obviously, the level of creativity that's easier to do when you have those mediums. Yeah, it's vibrant. It's got like a real multicultural kind of feel to it, because you're not just tied to like, well, what can we do by putting people in a rubber mask, right? By no means am I advocating I want to get back to the George Lucas, let's put everybody digitally in the background. But it does add a level of, you know, it makes you feel like the universe is bigger. The galaxy's bigger. Mm-hmm. This next story really caught my eye today. So Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, ongoing concern, been a pretty popular franchise since the mid-1980s. We've seen, cartoon series, we've seen video games, we've seen movies, and lots of different takes on the characters. But we've never seen one like what we're going to see next. So there was an announcement today that they're going to be adapting The Last Ronin, which is a book that came out in the last couple of years. And it is a very dark story by the original creators that focuses on a future wherein only one of the turtles is still alive. And he is sort of making his life in a dystopian New York City where Shredder's grandson is sort of in charge. And this book was very well received by the fans. You know, having the original creators, Eastman and Laird, come back and work on it. Yeah, it's really kind of gotten a lot of steam under, hey, it doesn't just have to be a franchise for kids. It can still be, you know, some of the original Turtle stories by Eastman and Laird were kind of grim and dark and interesting and scary. And so, you know, they're not saying like, hey, we're never going to do you know, Turtles for Kids anymore, but the idea that they're taking this swing and making an R-rated, violent, you know, take on the Turtles universe is kind of an interesting twist. So they're just obviously working, you know, on pre-production and getting this rolling now, so we probably won't see it for a couple of years, but I think it'd be interesting to see what people think of, you know, grown-up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, maybe not so much teenage anymore, but I'll be curious to see how they brand it, because, you know, the book itself is just called The Last Ronin. It'll be interesting to see if they do take away or add in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or how they reference that as they build it towards putting this out.
Yeah, the old 1990 live-action film was rated PG and was pretty adult for the time for that sort of material in the mainstream. And they sort of softened it quite a bit for part two and part three. So this one going in the opposite direction is interesting and reminds me of, and it almost feels like the equivalent of the Logan movie and what that did for Wolverine. Yeah. Going yeah. hard R and seeing a you know, in the future what happens kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good analogy. It could be really good. I'm hopeful. I thought Mutant Mayhem was a lot of fun. I really actually enjoyed that movie last year. But this idea really has kind of captured my imagination, and I guess a lot of other people, because it's going. So
you just remember, that's another movie I watched on the plane on the way home. they seem to be much younger portrayed in that last, you know, Ninja yep. Turtle movie, right?
Yep. Yeah, they definitely went for a more sort of kid-friendly, you know, much more young teenager-y kind of feel. Right. But this is going to be bloody, if the book is any judge.
Oh, I see, right. Okay. That kind of R. Okay, gotcha.
Oh, yeah. No, so the last Ronin in the book, and I'm not going to tell you which turtle it is, carries all of the weapons from all of the turtles and has now mastered all of them and uses them appropriately. And it's bloody.
Is he named after a famous Renaissance painter?
He is, actually. What a coincidence. Yes.
That's kind of a good clue. It's almost a giveaway.
Yeah.
Depends if he's a sculptor or a painter, though. That's the question.
Yeah, there you go. The next story. So they're remaking The Running Man. The classic.
Because money?
Well, in fairness, the movie version that was done in the 1980s or 90s, I guess, with Arnold Schwarzenegger based on a Stephen King. And Richard Dawson based on a Stephen King short story was not exactly what the book was like, which is not going to be a huge shock, but.
Really? Wow. Okay.
It's going to be directed by Edgar Wright, written and directed by Edgar Wright and starring Glenn Powell. They announced this today. So Wright had been attached previously as, you know, he might, this is kind of the thing he's working on next. Maybe he's going to do this. Now they've confirmed Glenn Powell's on board. Glenn Powell, obviously one of the hottest actors, both, you know, literally and figuratively in Hollywood right now. And the original story was in the book is about how this person who needs to pay for his daughter's medical bills ends mm-hmm. up going on this game show and is basically, it's like Hunt the Human. They obviously sort of hyper realize that in doing the Schwarzenegger version where, you know, it's much more, you know, sort of kitschy sci-fi, campy sci-fi kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. I think you could tell this story in a more realistic way, and it would probably still be really effective. I mean, the article that I've got us linked here from IO9 or Gizmodo is really good, because they point out in there, you know, in a world right now where A, people are struggling to pay their bills, B, where people will watch anything, you know, gruesome / violent on television and see, you know, there's like, you know, a huge divide between the rich and the poor. All those things are themes of The Running Man, and all those things are themes that could be really well looked at by somebody as smart as Edgar Wright. So mm-hmm. this could be really good, actually.
Neat.
And last thing I've got in here is great news for fans of Christopher Nolan. Of course, just took home his first Oscar for Oppenheimer. His movie Interstellar is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. And in doing that, they're going to be bringing it back to the theaters and showing it in IMAX in 70 millimeter. So this is a cool opportunity. If you didn't get a chance to see it in the theater, I didn't see it in the theater. My son, who's a huge fan of the director and his work, will be very excited. I sent him this story today and he was like, when can I buy tickets? I said, just stay tuned. It's not coming until this fall. Apparently it's coming in September. But yeah, I think this is, you know, they've been sort of bringing some of these great big screen movies back for limited engagements over the last little while. And I am all for this. I think if movie theaters are struggling to find ways to, you know, like, oh, box office disappointments and all these big tent poles. Yeah, show me the best version of the best movies. Like, bring back Interstellar for a couple weeks. See how it does. Bring back any great classic sci-fi movie, any, you know, like there's so many great, beautiful, you know, bring me Once Upon a Time in the West, bring me like all these beautiful 70 millimeter classics and give me the chance to see them how they were meant to be seen. Like, this is so smart. I wish they would do more of this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I go once or twice a year to see, I saw like Raiders of the Lost Ark last year. And Interstellar is a movie that, I have watched, I don't know, probably 10 times, maybe 20 times in since it came out. I did go and see it in the theater because it was I'm a space nut, as you know. But yeah, and I have it on Blu-ray and blah blah blah. I have it on my iTunes and I watch it every now and then. It's on the Netflix right now, I think, one of those two services.
Yeah. And I've done the same thing. I mean, we went and saw Back to the Future. There's been a few that they've sort of rolled out, but it's so funny because I hear, you know, the industry crying poor. I hear the movie theaters crying poor. You know, you don't have to just, obviously, yes, we want to see great new movies. Please keep making movies. As a matter of fact, make more movies for less so we can see better, good movies that are small, not just $300 million monsters. But there's an incredible catalog of movies that most people like. I mean, you know, Tim and you and I went and saw Clerks on a screen with one of the original film versions of it. And that was such a different experience. It was really interesting to see how that movie was originally made and shot and shown. It's completely different because for the home releases and for the streaming releases and everything else, it's been really cleaned up. It's been completely color timed. So everything, well, color timed, black and white timed in that case, so that everything is consistent. When you see how it was actually done on the film, it really changed my perspective on like, oh, this is really kind of a super, like you really understand that this was like low budget, you know, production. And yeah, it really brought a lot to it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of stories like that where you could really gain a lot from just seeing how these things were originally shown. And I think, you know, if these places are struggling for dough, this seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And I mean, that's just it. I mean, like yeah, I think I saw Jurassic Park in the theater, which I hadn't seen in forever, right? So, like these movies you see on the small screen is one thing. It might be different on the Vision Pro. But, you know, going to see them in the theater it's a different experience for sure. Like, you know,
and there is a difference too, you know, like I have seen some stuff we're lucky. We have the Lightbox in Toronto that shows classic movies and it's a really nice setup, but it's not an IMAX screen and it's not like the biggest screen you're going to come across.
Right.
I think it really does make a difference to be able to see these things like, you know, Missing You, the Uptown, but like you kind of want to see these things with big picture and big sound and really like, you know, feel it. And so, yeah, I think, you know, it's really nice when you can do that.
Well, like I went and saw two Terry Gilliam movies at the Bell Lightbox, which does have a big theater, like a big screen theater. One of the rooms is really big. And, you know, there's so much detail in each one of his shots that you miss on the small screen, right? So,
yeah.
Like there's stuff happening in the corners that you don't see, you know, if you're watching on a small screen. Definitely worth it. All right, let's move on to the main part of the show, which is why we're here. That's to talk about something Star Trek shaped. And this time we're talking about the final season, season 5 of Discovery, Star Trek Discovery, episode 3, Jinal.
Yep.
Which is what, the name of a planet? No.
No, it's the guy. It's the person, the Trill. The
dude, yes, okay. Yeah. The dude, the Trill. Yeah. So, elevator pitches. I'll go first. Sometimes a dick is just a dick.
Yes. I had to pew-pew or not to pew-pew. That is the question.
I couldn't get this into a singular sentence, so I sort of just had various takes on the, like, four storylines that were kind of going on, right? You got, you know, Michael Book and Culber, question mark, go on a nice walk. But everything else, you know, follows that theme of, like, reproduction. You've got Space Dad Stamets has to worry about Adira and the 50 Shades of Grey. Action Saru may have jeopardized his chances at getting some action. And Rainer adjusts to the motion in the demotion.
Oh, I mean, you're killing it today.
I was in a mood.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, putting Tilly against up against Rainer is a real sort of contrast in characters, right?
Well, they're just such, yeah, they're such different characters. It was very, very fun to watch the two of them duel. And the two actors did a wonderful job of that, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then my quote was around, you know, the makeup scene at in 10 Forward or whatever they call it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I just went. Sometimes you're just a dick. Like, I don't care how you try to apologize.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and maybe don't start your apologies with, looks like you're drinking something radioactive.
Yeah. Yeah. And like how she just walks away from him. Yep. Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it was a sort of typical glue episode in these season-long arcs where, you know, they're chasing the MacGuffin, where, mm-hmm. you know, we've got a little time to meet the new character. We've got a little time to talk about Saru, what his life's like on the space station and Federation headquarters. And he's, you know, we've also got the story of, you know, oh, we've got to go find this MacGuffin. So, yeah, it really was. And even within that, we also still had the Adira and Gray stuff. So there really was like all these sort of overlapping stories to sort of tie up some loose ends. So, you know, the big one that sort of resolved was we got some closure with Adira and Gray as their relationship comes to an end. I'll be curious to go back when the series is completely finished and watch it from beginning to end and see how I feel about it. Right now, it didn't affect me in any way whatsoever. And, you know, I'm like, I thought those two were cute, and obviously they had a complex relationship with obviously Gray being dead and living inside of Adira for a while there. But I didn't find their relationship, because it's been so out of mind. I don't really feel like it really hit me at all. Like, oh no, how sad or whatever. Not that it was like the saddest of endings. They just kind of realized that they wanted to go different places, and it's what happens with some relationships, but it was, it wasn't really a very emotive moment. And, you know, the Saru stuff with Tarina, it was fine, but I don't know, more like a plot from the West Wing than it was from Star Trek, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was not, again, the stakes were really low. Like, oh no, like worst case scenario, she isn't present anymore and they still live together. Like, I don't know. Yeah, it just felt like this episode was a little all over the place. And the Rainer stuff was fun and funny. But again, it was sort of a distraction. Like, it wasn't really... The main part of this was the whole, they go to Trill, they need to find this thing. The big puzzle is, you know, well, will you kill to get what you want, or will you find a different way? Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm all over the place because this episode was all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a bit weird.
I mean, did they try and pack too much in this one?
Yeah, I think that's why I had a little bit of an issue with trying to come up with one, you know, quick sentence. I think the out of universe reason might be some of the rethinking they had to do when they discovered, no pun intended, that this was the final season from Paramount. So I wonder if they had to say, all right, we got to like squish some things in somewhere to get this to level out for the rest of the show. Maybe they had to be like, hey, what happens here? This couple, guess what? They broke up. What happens to this one? This dude takes a new job. This lady and this guy get engaged. Moving on, you know, trying to adjust to some various things. That's what I would guess happens. It moved fairly quickly. I think you're right in your assessment that I don't think the breakup really hit me in any particular way. But I also, I also kind of wonder if it really could, just given like the, you know, they're so young that it's almost like a puppy love kind of thing. I'm jaded in my old manhood now that I'm like, yeah, you'll find somebody else. You'll be all right. This is a tough one, but kind of having a Jet Reno sort of approach to it, of like, there's something here that's going on, and they're going to need help, but they're really just going to need, like, you know, like a shoulder to cry on, and not really like you be helpful in any actual meaningful way.
Yeah, there's plenty of trail in the pond.
Yeah, exactly.
I did like when Tig Notaro as Jet Reno says, "Come on, Space Dad." He's just such the voice of like the audience in this show sometimes, of like, yes, when your daughter says everything's okay, it's not. Get a clue. Like,
yeah.
All right, let's pew pew pew. What'd you guys have for your pew pew pew? Is there any answer besides dodging the giant space bugs?
Yeah, not really.
That's what I put, fighting the invisible Starship Trooper bugs.
Yeah. Well, and you can also go for the interpersonal pew pews, and that's Rainer versus everybody, right?
Yeah, the Rainer versus Tilly was pretty funny.
Yeah, because she's like not, you know, I like the part where she says, you know, I'm not allowed to speak freely, but so I'm going to do it anyway, right? So.
Yeah, I had that in the quotes, yeah.
Yeah.
The Easter egg hunt, I didn't see a lot. I definitely recognized the name Zenkethi when it came up. Jaime, I know, is it another DS9 head? You probably heard your ears perk up at that one. So I copied in the article from Memory Alpha here, if you want to have a look at that, dear listeners. But the Zenkethi is a race of... a species that live in the Alpha Quadrant with, you know, Romulans and humans and everyone else. And in a couple of episodes of DS9 during the Dominion War, the Dominion essentially tried to trick the Federation or the Starfleet into attacking them, so that they would basically be drawn into another front on the war. And so we know the Zenkethi are big and powerful species in the 24th century. We don't know what they're like now, although Burnham does sort of say in this episode, you know, it's going to take some time to negotiate us even being allowed to go there. So
right.
It'd be interesting to hear sort of where the Zenkethi are 800 years in the future.
Well, another Easter egg was the very beginning, the USS Lockerup, which is, I looked it up, and it's a hill or an island in, was it Rwanda? Wasn't it just like the 30th anniversary of the genocide in somewhere?
In Rwanda, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
When you said locker up, I immediately went to Donald Trump. I don't know why.
I was really confused on that one. I was like, I kind of need to see a spelling of that.
Yeah.
Turn on the closed caption.
I think it just came back. I looked it up on the... it's actually got somebody's got USS Lockerup in here already, but Lockerup Map Hill in northern Uganda. Maybe that's where.
Oh, Uganda. Okay.
Yeah, but wasn't it just a Ugandan something or other that the United States had a big ceremony for, or maybe Canada did? I just thought it was interesting. Why would they put that on the ship in the very opening scene? Unless it was a Star Trek type commentary on that, right? And then the other Easter egg for me was the whole plot about, you know, the strange creatures that are killing everybody, but it turns out they're just protecting their eggs, is a throwback to the Devil in the Dark episode from the original series.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another classic Trek trope to slip in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, good call. Yep. They said what? Best quotes... I will finish this quote without using an expletive that'll get us a mature rating on our podcast feed, but everyone's on a journey. We come together, we come apart. Wow. I just sounded like a woo woo blank from Reno.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny. When Rainer talks to Reese and asks him to tell about himself in 20 words or less, he finishes up and he says, "That was 22 words. Thank you. Dismissed."
Right.
Yeah, just gives you a nice, succinct 3-sentence response to why Rainer's a bit of a dick. And since you won't give me a chance to speak freely, I'm just going to take it from Tilly. That was the line you mentioned, Tim.
And there were lots of Earthisms, like, because these aliens
break
were
the ice,
like,
yeah.
breaking the ice and stuff like that. But the one was the one that he said, herrings aren't red.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was,
the red herring, yeah.
Janelle said that.
Yeah.
And she says, that's kind of the point.
Yep.
I had the quote from Janelle inhabiting Culber saying, wow, this guy really works out.
Certainly. That made me laugh too, because that if anybody who follows him on social media knows, he is buff as hell.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely tons of Easter eggs. They name check the Dominion War as a reason for, like, why, you know, hey, Federation is cool. Why can't they have access to technology 800 years ago? Like, well, kind of not a good time, but this could have been an easy weapon to use, right? One at the right time. During one of the staff interviews, or, you know, 20 words or less with Rayner, I've immediately caused some fact checking. I don't remember which member of the staff says that they're, like, super good at the Tongo game, so that still continues to hang around. I believe that was a Ferengi serving a drink.
I saw that. It's unclear to me, are the people who are the staff on the starship, are they enlisted members of the Starfleet quote unquote military? are they, like, you know, like, are you like a purser or a yeoman or something when you're doing that? Or are you just like, hey, I got this job, it's on a bar that's attached to a starship, like
R2-D2
8 forward, you know?
Yeah
Like, what's like, do you actually have to have a military commission in order to serve drinks at the bar on that? Or you just got to pass a security screening? Like, what's
the... Oh, yeah, like the whole Neelix thing. Like, why did they keep him around, right?
But yeah.
Yeah, hard to say. It's interesting.
Yeah, it gets a little sort of uncomfortable when you have these grand speeches that are like, well, you know, every member of this crew is ready to lay down their lives for the good of the galaxy. It's like, what about that dude? All he's doing is serving drinks. Does that dude, like, have to sign a waiver or something? Because I'm not sure that he agreed, you know, or was fully informed of the, well, we're just going to have to ram this Borg ship and 10 forward is the first thing to go.
Yeah, I, like, really, like, what's, you know, when they say, you know, oh, everyone, emerge, red alert, we're going to battle stations. What's the Ferengi bartender's battle station? Do they stay there in case somebody needs a drink? Do you clean the bar up? Do you go and hide under the bar? Like, what's your job then?
I'm watching my dog counter surf upstairs.
No, not your dog, no.
Hmm. The new one.
Yeah, a shocking turn. He was trying to do that here, too. Okay, so I had a big question here, and it ties to the stuff that we didn't talk about for this, just recap, was the Stamets stuff, right? So Stamets is sort of trying to piece together, like, well, you know, what do we know about this stuff, whatever, and then figures out this, you know, because Reno says something about half-life, and then he's like, oh, half-life? I didn't calculate for that, and he figures out this stuff. So he's trying to figure out the progenitor's technology, and he extrapolates this. He's discussing with Rayner, who gives him a larger word count for his speech, because, you know, and so essentially what he's saying is these progenitors had the ability, and the technology they're looking for has the ability to create life and could resurrect old life and do all these things. Where that's going, I'm curious, but also
it's a search for Spock, obviously.
Well, that's honestly, my mind immediately went to what's Bill Shatner doing right now, because maybe he's going to show up in the final episode where they're like,
well, he was on Kimmel a couple of days ago saying that he regretted his last scene in the show. They had him recreate it and say what he wanted to say. The way he died, he didn't like the way he...
Yeah, he's... So. Well, I mean, obviously, he wrote, like, 3 books, basically undoing that, right?
Did he? Okay.
Yeah, those Star Trek books that he wrote were all about how, you know, but what if instead there were nanobots and he was brought back to life and there was the Borg?
Yeah,
and anyway. Okay, but what it really tweaked for me was essentially what Stamets was describing is how these... He's like, you know, essentially what these things are is the closest you can come to touching the hand of God, right? Like, these are the people that are responsible for creating life in our universe. Okay, so what that is basically as a philosophy is the philosophy, or the sort of pseudo-psychological theory or pseudo-intellectual theory of intelligent design, right? So intelligent design is an argument for the existence of God, and this, I've got my Wikipedia article here, presented by its proponents as an evidence-based scientific theory about life's origins. Proponents claim that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection. Essentially, it's an offshoot of creationism. It's saying that just because we have science doesn't mean that we weren't created by someone or something. In this case, they're talking about that as a cause for the existence of God. What Stamets is essentially saying here is that these creatures, these progenitors, are essentially God. So in the year 3191, are we essentially saying that these people who believe in intelligent design were proven right?
That's a really good question.
Because that's kind of what it feels like. Like, it's almost like a validation for this. Now, I don't know anyone who believes in intelligent design, or at least that they have not expressed that to me. I would like, if, God forbid, any listeners out there, and I use the God term particularly to make this pun, if you believe that there is an intelligent design and that God created, you know, life, and that there was an intelligent design behind this, we'd love to hear. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to know what you think about this as a Star Trek plot, because right now this is considered a pretty fringe theory. It's a way to try and incorporate scientific knowledge into the idea of a belief in a god, and to have your cake and eat it too. But it's not a widely, obviously, accepted scientific theory, given that science will tell you that there is no God. And I've stunned my teammates to death.
Yes, you have.
Now a word from our sponsor.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Now back to the show.
On that happy note, should we move on to our watch list?
Yes, let's move on to that watch list.
All right.
We contemplate the universe and our place in it.
Yes.
Okay, so I flagged this one last week, but we had a lot of stuff in there, so I moved it to this week. There's a new short movie on YouTube called The Spider Within, A Spider-Verse Story, and it is an animated short film, but 6-7 minutes long, that is set around the Miles Morales character from the Spider-Verse movies. It's looks like it's right out of there. It's you know, no difference in animation, everything else. And it's basically about how Miles has so much on his mind. He's got all these stresses. He's got his life as Spider-Man. He's got his duality of his life and all the stresses he's feeling. And it's obviously being done as a metaphor for every kid's got this, every person's got this, all these things swirling around in their head. And it was basically done as a more or less a PSA, right? It's the after school special. It's an after school special, right? It's, you know, hey, Miles has got all this stuff in his head. His picture is of, you know, much obviously more serious stuff with, you know, fighting supervillains and keeping his identity of a superhero secret from his parents. But it's basically about how, you know, when you're feeling overwhelmed, when you're feeling daunted, when you're feeling frustrated, when you're feeling depressed, when you're feeling anxious, you should talk to someone. You can talk to your parents, hopefully. You can talk to your friends. You can, you know, look out for that. So this, if you read the notes that come on this YouTube channel, this was done in partnership as part of a sort of, you know, an initiative to educate people to, you know, obviously use these characters that people love to, you know, what does it say in here? It's done with in collaboration with the Kevin Love Fund, designed to destigmatize mental health challenges and ensure people who are struggling have the tools needed to thrive. So it's kind of weird in that it, you know, like it fits in with the Miles character that we know from the movies. And it does speak to obviously what a lot of people go through with their mental health struggles. I I think I've talked about in the episodes before. I have my struggles with anxiety and depression. I have for years. And I found this really quite good. And I'm glad that more and more we're starting to see that destigmatization of like, oh, well, you know, if, you know, 30 years ago, it'd be like, well, have a drink or have a whatever, you know, self-medicate or whatever. And now it's talk to somebody, tell them how you're feeling, go through that stuff. You know, I found that when I'm dealing with my mental health issues, that's exactly what I need to do. I can't keep it all inside. I got to talk to people because otherwise I'll go crazy. And yeah, I thought this was a really very poignant, very quick, very smart, and very obviously connected to what is very popular way of telling this very important message. So we've got the YouTube link in here and it's in the show notes. Please have a look. And obviously, if you are dealing with your mental health, take care of yourself and make sure that you get the care you need.
Cool. Yeah, I watched this one on Disney Plus, probably Disney Plus. Maybe it was on YouTube. I can't remember where I saw it, given that it's a Sony Pictures item. But I thought it was really well done from that that aspect of sort of grounding this kind of really wacky, you know, Spider-Man's wacky as it is, Miles Morales is even wackier, and really grounding that that character. What it would be like to be a teen as a superhero with all this stuff going on is, I think, pretty well handled in a breezy, 7 minutes and 14 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, tapping into that kind of, you know, that was one of the biggest movies of last year. The first one was a huge success, won an Oscar. I think tapping into an audience that is going to be like, oh, there's a new Spider-Man short, and then obviously giving them that message to a young audience, to an audience, a broad audience, is really smart. So I think this is great, and I absolutely applaud them for doing it. It's also just a really neat little story, like, you know, just Miles, little moment inside Miles's head of what's going on in there, right? Next up in my watch list, so we're getting down to the last few episodes of Star Wars The Bad Batch. I wanted to check in with the two of you about it and see if you're watching, if you're keeping up with it, and just my thoughts and yours. Have you two been keeping up with it?
Yep.
I mean, Bad Batch, I have. Yeah, I was trying to think, like, did I watch the most recent episode? And like, yes, I did.
Yeah. So this season obviously has been a real, you know, kind of series of mostly setbacks. I mean, obviously we did get the, you know, the reuniting of Crosshair with the rest of the Bad Batch and stuff. But this season's been a real bit of a roller coaster and a lot of down moments too. You know, people getting hurt, you know, they lost yet another home base / spaceship. But you can see this sort of building to a crescendo. And this has been a really kind of interesting season. It definitely feels like it's got a propulsive force to it that maybe some of the other seasons didn't have as much, little less fluff. You can argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but what are your impressions so far of this season as we get down to, I think we've got 3 or 4 episodes to go.
It's interesting. It's a little bit more, I guess, compelling than previous ones. The other seasons, the stories seem to be a little disjointed in some senses, but this one's sort of the mystery of the M count. I wonder what the M stands for. Yeah, and Omega's place in as a clone. You know, I was looking at Hunter today. He's got a hook nose. I'm thinking, like, how did he get a hook nose if he's a clone? But
I honestly, my impression was that it had been broken. Maybe. Because Wrecker's covered in scars too. Like Wrecker's face is a mess. He's got obviously one of his eyes is messed up. He's got a big scar on his face. He's got his hairline. He's got like burn marks on it.
He's all pumped up too. That's the other thing too about Wrecker, right?
Yeah, I mean they each had different attributes given to them that were heightened. But I think the whole point is that these guys have seen a lot.
But I mean the whole mystery throughout the whole Bad Batch series has been okay, what is the deal with Omega? And then this other doctor with the red glasses.
Yeah, Emery,
she's a clone too, right?
She is. She's her sister essentially through cloning.
Yeah, because she's almost got the same accent. It's almost like the same actress doing the voice, right?
Oh, it is the same actress doing the voice.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. So like you get hints of it every now and then, that sort of Australian New Zealand twang. Right?
Yeah. What do you think, Jaime?
Yeah, I'm liking the season because it does have more of a straight through line of the story arc, the mystery of what's going on with Omega. I think some of the other seasons, you know, they had good one-offs, but some of it was adventure of the week for them. a little bit of moving forward. And this one's like, all right, let's just, you know, somehow Palpatine returned. It seems to be the, like, this is the somehow
the running theme,
for the story, it seems.
Yeah.
And I have enjoyed Crosshair quite a bit in this season, and especially as he's interacted with Omega and the rest of the Bad Batch.
Yeah. I'm curious to see, you know, as we wind up, I think it's ending just a few days before Star Wars Day. I think it's ending on the 1st of May. So 3 weeks from now, it'll be interesting to see if they can come up with a satisfying ending. And if they truly are ending things, there's rumors that they're already working on the next Star Wars cartoon series that hasn't been announced yet. And because this story is tied into some of the other stories going forward, I guess I'm wondering if we're going to see a live action Bad Batch at any point, if we're going to see any carry on, or is this, like, you know, maybe a suicide mission kind of ending? You know, I'll be really curious to see how they decide to resolve all this.
Yeah. Well, have we seen any of the clones in, other than the original clone, have we seen any of them?
No.
In any of the live action movies?
No. And, you know, so where we're at in the timeline here is well before, obviously, the Ahsoka Rebels, all that, you know, like of that stuff. Okay. In Rebels, we see Rex, we see Wolf, we see, like, some of these characters that have popped up in Bad Batch, but we've never seen the Batch anywhere outside of this other than the last season of Clone Wars where they debuted.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, like, Rex. Have we seen Rex anywhere? But
Rex,
like,
we saw in Rebels, so we know that Rex is there, and they've confirmed that Rex was at the Battle of Endor. That's canon now. So we know Rex lives till at least the end of Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really know much about the Bad Batch. It doesn't matter if we don't know anything about what happened to the Bad Batch.
What side would Rex have been on? Rebel side?
Yeah. At the end of Clone Wars, gets his chip removed by Ahsoka. So he's got sort of self-control. And then in this last couple seasons of Bad Batch, he's working to try and help free other clones from Empire control. And he's also, he comes back in Rebels, right? And he comes back, he's an older man. That's where he's shaved his head. He's got the white beard.
Yeah, right.
And
he comes back
and he kind of mentors them a little bit. And then he sort of becomes active in the rebellion. And then from there, there's a scene in the actual Return of the Jedi where there is one of the rebel commandos on the moon of Endor is a person with a noticeably white beard. And a lot of fans were like, hey, wouldn't it be awesome? Like, once we saw older Rex in Rebels, people were like, hey, wouldn't it be awesome if that was Rex? Maybe that's Rex. Again, in the moment, it was just a guy with a white beard dressed up like a rebel commando in the background.
But they've since
confirmed that, yes, that was supposed to be Rex. They've basically retconned that so that they can say that he was there.
Okay.
So
George Lucas planned it all along.
Back in 1977. If you're not careful, there'll be a prequel movie about it. Last thing I've got for the watch list this week is Rebel Moon. Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, is coming in a few days. And so I wanted to also check in on this one with you two. I think we talked briefly maybe about Rebel Moon sometime over the past few months. I watched the first one. It was very much like every other movie by that director, Zack Snyder, in that it looked great, but ultimately was kind of wishy-washy and didn't really satisfy me as somebody with a brain. It was very pretty. He makes beautiful films. He always has. He is an absolute master of the visual canvas. He just should stop writing entirely because he's just a terrible, 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 terrible writer. That being said, I'm like, am I going to watch part two? Yeah, I'll probably watch part two.
Yeah, just for closure. Yeah,
just for the closure of it. And, I, you know, again, some good characters and you know, different actors and stuff that I like in there. But ultimately, that whole first movie, it was just like,
It's just not Interstellar.
It's just not good dialogue. It's not good character development. There's so many things missing that are so fundamental. Like, at no point was I like, oh no, not that character. I was like, I don't care about any of it. It's the same problem with the DCU stuff. Like, I just didn't care about any of it. Ultimately, because he didn't do a good job of making them likable, interesting characters. And the same thing goes for Rebel Moon. So I'm curious. Yeah, are you guys, Jaime, did you watch the first one? And are you interested in the second one?
I purposely didn't watch the first because I said, let me see what other people say, and worst case, I'll wait till the second one comes out and just watch them together.
Yeah.
Well, your time is nigh because it's coming in a couple weeks. My advice would be, just long as you know what you're getting into. Again, I think Sucker Punch is an incredible movie. It's really, really interesting. The visual tapestry is so beautifully woven together, but the moment somebody opens their mouth, you're like, what are you talking about? This is such terrible dialogue and such badly written characterization, but man, does it look good. And that's the same thing as this one. It's like, Jesus, if they could just get somebody in there to actually write good dialogue, they might have actually had something here. They've already put out a comic book, that's not actually an adaptation. It's actually like expanding the story and stuff like that. Like, I think they had in mind, you know, I mean, Netflix doesn't get into the business of getting into making big budget sci-fi movies unless they think it's going to be a thing. And they kind of pulled out all the stops on this, but I don't know. I don't know if this is what they wanted. I don't know if this is what they thought they were getting for this money, but ugh.
Okay, I think you're up, Jaime.
Yeah, last time I mentioned how I appreciated the way that X-Men 97 handles the optic blasts power for Cyclops. And there's a short little video here. It's like 2 minutes and 18 seconds long, saying how X-Men 97 faithfully depicts Cyclops' powers. Got mild spoilers for like the very intro part of the very first episode or two. But if it gives you the sort of same gist I gave of, like, it's not really supposed to be like a heat laser beam kind of thing. It's really more of like getting hit with like, a fire hose. It's concussive. It hits you and you feel pressure from it. And just like you can cut, you know, steel and rock metal type stuff with boulders with high pressurized water jets. Think of that same sort of thing of like, oh, well, why can you cut this thing? It's like, well, because you focused the concussive power in such a way to do that.
Yeah, when I was a young man, I bought the official handbooks of the Marvel Universe, which were these indispensable in a pre-internet world books that basically talked about. They were just filled with biographies of all the characters in the Marvel Universe to that point, even the ones who were dead. They did these great volumes. I think they've made an omnibus edition of this in the recent past. I think you can actually still get these. But it basically tells you, you know, their origin story as much as people knew about them. It tells you, you know, all their key data. It's basically like, you know, it's the collector card version of all these characters. But for some of them, it really kind of gets into some details. And one of the details in there is it talks about like what Cyclops's mask does, the thing that he wears over his eyes. And it, in one of those books, it basically says it's not just about keeping his, you know, his concussive blasts out from hitting people. He can actually use that visor. So in some of the old comics, especially the older ones, and maybe I haven't read X-Men for a while, but he actually puts his hand to his temple because he's using that to basically adjust the beam. And he can have a really wide, you know, it's almost a shotgun and a rifle, right? He can open it up wide and have a less impactful but wider focus blast, or he can narrow down the focus and have a much more focus, like you were talking about, basically like a power washer. He can actually use that to make a hole in something if he really wants to. I think it's really great that they're clarifying that, because I think a lot of people, especially from the comic books or from the comics with the movies, didn't really get the fact, like when they see this blast come up people's eyes and it's red, they immediately think laser. That's not the case at all. So this is great that they're actually like really bringing it back to its roots.
Indeed.
I do want to ask, Jaime, where are you on the three-body problem?
I finished it up. So I've seen the magical number five.
episode. All right, all right. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't finished Three Body Problem.
Yeah.
What what'd you think of episode 5, Jaime?
It's pretty nuts. And it kind of builds some tension there too, because once you see, oh, so they've got this nanofiber, they've made it, you know, impressively small, and they set up these girders that can come up. I'm like, oh, I think I see what's going to happen here.
Did you really? Okay.
Yeah, because I said, what would I do? Like, what would I do? You know, when given the constraints, they said, like, well, we can't necessarily, you know, do some pew pew pews because we might blow up the thing we want to get. Okay, can we gas them? No guarantee in a ship that size that will gas everyone at the same time before they can destroy the thing we want. Can we send special forces? It'd be a bloodbath. We have no idea how many crew are on board.
Yeah, we wouldn't want a bloodbath.
So, well, I think the intention maybe wasn't, you know, handled well. There was like bloodbath without a guarantee of winning. And then they said, what if we had a guarantee of winning? Which honestly, in show, they got super close to not winning. They were just like a misstep away from it going wrong for them. Kind of nuts that it starts out with like, hey, just like we were talking about. Hey, remember how the Enterprise has like a kindergarten on it or more? Yeah. What happens to another ship that also has a kindergarten on it or more?
Yeah. And like they literally go through like compartment by compartment and show you like, oh, this is a happy little community of, you know, cultists and whatever. And they're like, and they go to the cafeteria and it's literally Taco Tuesday. Like, it's just, it's so like, it just hammers it home. And then, of course, they cut to the scene afterwards when one of the characters walks by and sees like a foot sticking out of a child's shoe. Like, oh, It's a weird show. It's a genuinely weird show. I liked it. I liked it a lot. But I also found myself being like, they pushed the boundaries pretty hard on that episode. It's hard to see the good guys as good guys and the bad guys as bad guys when stuff like that's going down.
Yeah, when you get around to reading the book, it'd be interesting to see if that scene actually, because I don't remember that scene from the book. Mm. But then again, audio book format, walking a dog, you're not really always focused in on the nuance of everything, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, so kind of interesting. Cool. Anyway, so a couple of things that I've been watching and I have seen. One is the completely made up Adventures of Dick Turpin. I'm a huge Noel Fielding fan. Mm. This is he was a highwayman back in the highwayman days of England, mm-hmm. Robbing stagecoaches and stuff like that. And he was a real character, but I don't know that this is sort of a sort of Monty Python-esque. Take Mighty Boosh is the show that Noel Fielding comes from. That very, very similar kind of like tongue firmly planted in cheek, super funny. Look at, you know, sort of semi medieval times, right? So check that one out. I've been watching Constellation on Apple TV as well. Dick Turpin's on Apple TV, and so is Constellation. Constellation stars Noomi. What's her name? Noomi
Rapace.
Yeah, from the Dragon Tattoo Girl.
The original Dragon Tattoo Girl.
Yeah. Yeah, the original one. Interesting story. It's a bit, it's a multiverse kind of story, about, you know, space travel and stuff like that. And it's funny cause I've seen a couple of shows lately where, the space station is in disaster. I'm trying to think of the other show that I watched that had where the space station was getting sucked into something or other, but, I haven't seen the last episode. I think it's either today or this week or next week, but starts out really well, and it's kind of stretches your ability to sort of you really have to hang
suspend disbelief. Yeah,
you have to spend that quite a bit. But it's an interesting story. It gets a little lost in some of the things that go on in the story, but. It's interesting. I wouldn't say it's like, it's not for all mankind. It's not, you know, if you miss it, don't worry about it. Mm. And I also saw a movie, which is kind of sort of fits into our format here. And it's a dystopian, oh, the whole world's gone to hell in a handbasket, sort of like, you know, kind of like we went through in the last 4 years. This is about a flood in London, where a woman who, has a boyfriend, is pregnant, about to give birth, and at the same time, London is flooded with these huge rains, and everybody has to leave their homes and go off and survive and live in camps and go off to, like, you know, sanctuaries and things like that. And then she makes her way back home to, or trying to make her way back home with the baby. So it's starting Jodie Comer too, which is interesting because, you know, such a good actress, I should say. It's interesting. I'm looking at the notes in IMDb. I didn't realize that nobody has a name in this movie.
Hmm.
So yeah, she's just called Woman, and then everybody else is just an initial, right? So, but it's kind of, it's a bit like, it reminded me of, Children of Men, mm-hmm. You know, the other dystopian movie. Have you ever seen that one, John?
Oh, like a while ago.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of that same sort of sense of, like, you know, the world's gone to heck in a handbasket, right? So but interesting movie. It was really, really good. It was like, it was out, I guess last year. It was in the theater. So or in demand or whatever. But I don't even know where can you watch this. I don't know. But yeah, it was. Oh, it's on Prime. It looks like no, rent or buy on Prime. So I don't know if it's actually on Prime. So yeah, so I guess it's still, oh, is that TIFF? That's where it was. So it's just came out. So, but that's it, and that's it for this week and all of us here on the podcast. So Jonathan, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKnews, or on YouTube at youtube.com/@JPK.
Great. And Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you,
I'm on Twitter as @DevTheHair.
All right. And my name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where I can be found, on the Mastodon machine, on the Instagram machine, most of the machines, as I said last time, and every time before that. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 You've been listening to the Spotcast podcast. This is CNN.
What's that? Oh, I just thought the James Earl Jones thing was kind of cool. Oh, wrong show. Right.
If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
We just got to sign off by breaking into, I can't remember which boy band did Bye Bye Bye, but we'll have to do our final three-part harmony of Bye Bye Bye.
Backstreet Boys or something?
Yeah, it's one of the Backstreet Boys.
Well, I don't really know that, because there's a laundry commercial with them in right now.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw that one.
Yeah. Actually, I saw New Kids on the Block are playing at Massey Hall.
Oh, pity.
Yeah. And speaking of concert ticket prices, have you noticed that Sting has added 5 shows at his Massey Hall run? I think they're doing like a small bowl. They're not selling the top balcony seats.
Oh, I thought I saw that too. Yeah. Because I thought that was weird.
The ticket prices are like $600. It's like, your head a shake.
Yeah.
You know, I know you're Sting and everything, but I've seen him like umpteen times. I've never paid that kind of money to see him play.
Yeah, it's funny. It feels like, obviously, the smaller venue, they don't make as much revenue. But then it's not like they're like, hey, you can see him in a really small venue. You're like, oh, cool. But then it's also you're paying the massive premium for that experience.
Yeah. And so much so that like you could fill that place, you know, 5 times or 4 times and you have to just do these smaller shows. I don't know.
Yeah, well, option is to protest and not go.
Yeah, it's pretty much what I'm electing for. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, I'm going to see a band from the 70s, and the only reason I'm going to see them is the ticket was $25, one of those $25 Massey Hall special, you know, like the summer blockbuster ticket sales that they had, right? Mm-hmm. So otherwise, I wouldn't go. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, I get it. I understand that, you know, like we were talking at the beginning of the show about, you know, you don't have the DVD sales to back up the movies, so jack up the prices, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think it's gotten out of hand is what I'm where I'm going with that, I think, right? Ticket pricing.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they were talking to someone about sort of, you know, can you glimpse into the future where this technology is going and blah, blah, blah. And the thought was, you know, are we going to see a lot of movie theaters close because people aren't going as much and it's changing the experience? And what the person responded with was, you know, yes, there will probably over the course of time be less theaters, just because the demand isn't quite as high as it used to be. But then they'll have to find different ways to sort of, you know, make revenue off of the ones mm-hmm. that continue to exist. And I was like, yeah, great. And like right now to go see an IMAX movie is, you know, like $20, $21 or something yeah. like that. I'm like, yep. How badly do you want to see the new, you know, insert movie here when, you know, we already have all these streaming services that are costing us money every month and everything. I'm like, what's the cap? What's the most you'd pay to see? Like, they're already doing stuff like, you know, premium pricing. The Cineplex here in Canada added the, like, you know, convenience fee for booking online, which is a load of horse poop as far as I'm concerned, as far as that's just another gouge. It's like another couple bucks in their pocket every time somebody buys a ticket. I wonder what the number is where you'd be like, yeah, I'm not going to go see movies anymore. They're just too stupidly expensive.
Yeah. When the cheapest seat in the house is over $120, I think that's the end point for me.
Well, and again, it's the difference between like, okay, you brought a band and you had to get them here and everything else. Like a movie is literally like digitally transmitted to the theaters now. So there's no overhead. Like it's just about like keeping the movie theater clean and stuff. Yeah. How much would you pay to see a movie for that? $20, $25, $30. If somebody said to you right now, yeah, if you want to see Dune 2 in the movie theaters, it's going to be $35. Would you be like, yeah, what the heck? Or would you be like, I don't think so, because I think that's too much for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the concept of them becoming like events.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to be hundreds of dollars, but it probably does switch the model quite a bit there.
Well, and if the future holds is that less people are going to the theater, but that the people who are going really want the best experience, it's like, okay, cool. Then, you know, they got to do better than what they do now, which is just like a giant warehouse with a screen at the front of it. And, you know, they do have those premium VIP theaters and stuff like that. Like, yeah, if there were, instead of right now, I think in Mississauga, there's like five major theaters and probably a few smaller ones. If there was one or two, and you knew that, like, it would be almost like getting theater tickets, or, well, yeah, probably more like a theater and less like a concert. If you were getting theater tickets and you knew that, like, yeah, Dune 2 is going to play for 1 month. It's going to be in this one place that you can go, and you basically have to buy your tickets in advance. And it's, yeah, it just essentially becomes an event because there's going to be a maximum cap, just like there is for a theater performance, of how many seats they can sell over that course of time. They can't keep extending it or whatever. Yeah, would that change what you're willing to spend and how often you're willing to go, all those kinds of things? I think it's an interesting discussion because I don't think it's very hard to predict that that's where this is going. I don't know. I don't know what I pay for. Like, there's only two movies this year that I really want to see in the theater. Dune 2 is one of them. Deadpool and Wolverine is the other one. There's a bunch of other movies that are coming out that I think would be good in the theater. But if I don't see them, I don't care. And I love going to the movies. Like, I am an avid, lifelong lover of going to the movie theater. And for me to be like, yeah, if I only see two movies in the theater this year, that's fine. That's saying something.
Mm-hmm. So before we go, did you see the eclipse on Monday, John?
The which?
The eclipse, you know.
The eclipse. No, I was inside. I did not get myself any kind of viewing apparatus or anything. But I did.
Was it sunny or cloudy where you were?
It was cloudy, but it like basically. So basically, what we got here was.
We probably had the same as we had
light, dark, light, you know, like yeah, that was yeah. really the experience of the whole thing for me was light out and then it was dark out and then it was light out 5 minutes later.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there any effect at all in Seattle? I mean, nothing, I guess. Right.
No, we were completely overcast. So nothing.
Yeah. We were too.
Your picture made me laugh so hard, Jaime, on Monday.
The rain
of the raindrops rolling down the window. I was like, that is the most Seattle picture I've ever seen of any event outside. It made me laugh so hard.
This basically was, there was a, few websites that you could put in your zip code and see how much is hypothetically available to you based on where you are on Earth. And for us, we would have gotten like 15 to 20% tops. And that's in a completely clear day sort of scenario.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, got to run. Got to go find out what the dogs are doing.
I'm going to say eating things off your counter.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I can hear them barking, but I don't know what the little one was. The little one came and visited me during the show a couple of times, but alrighty.
All right. Talk to you next week, guys.
Ciao.
Bye. Later.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.